Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've heard the horror stories, zebra mussels decimating the native clam population in the Great Lakes, the Asian longhorn beetles destroying trees here in the Northeast, nutria ravaging Louisiana's coastal marshes, and African killer bees on the attack in the Southwest. Invasive species are crisscrossing the globe and threatening biodiversity as we know it. Or are they? In his new book, Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasives Aren't All Bad, Dr. Ken Thompson argues that invasive species often cause far less damage than we might imagine, and that the cost of eradicating them often outweighs the benefits. Thompson was for 20 years a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield. Dr. Ken Thompson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi there.
Well, let's start with the question that you pose in the title of your book. Where do camels belong?
Well, I pose that question because it doesn't have a simple answer. Humans are very short-sighted kind of people. We never really look beyond, you know, the next election, and quite often not beyond the end of next week, quite honestly. And so we assume that the way the world is today is the way it's always been. So we assume that something that's where it is now is where it's always been and where it should be. So most of your listeners won't know that camels evolved in North America, and that there were dozens of species of camels that lived in North America for 40 million years, and that they only went extinct in North America 8,000 years ago. So, which is you know, yesterday in geological time.
There were some definitions that were used back in the mid-19th century by a couple of notable British botanists who used this concept of native and alien when it came to species. Now, was this a scientific definition, or was there something else at play here?
No, it was meant to be a scientific definition. They basically said if a species is where it is today and got there naturally on its own, then it's native. But if it was introduced by humans or in any way humans were involved in moving it to where it is now, then it's not native, then it's an alien. That was their definition. And that's really the definition we've stuck with ever since. We've kind of extended the sort of legal definition that we have in most countries of who is a legal citizen of that country.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tended to sort of extend that legal definition, you know, do you have the right kind of passport or not, to animals and plants. But they don't, you know, they haven't read the book, you know, they don't have passports.
It seems, though, that the definition of native changes depending on what is the perceived value of the species. In fact, you write about a British quote-unquote plant called Fritillaria meleagris. Tell us more about this plant.
Well, we have this particular problem in Britain because our entire flora and fauna only arrived here very recently at the end of the last ice age. and so we look at things and we often decide whether they're native or alien or not on the basis of whether we like them. So Fritillaria meleagris is a kind of conservation icon in Britain. It's a really pretty plant that grows in sort of hay meadows and things. And people spend lots of time conserving it. But in fact, it's really only been here a few hundred years, and it's a garden escape. It was originally brought into the country from Europe as an ornamental, but it's escaped into wild habitats, and now people use it as a kind of barometer of the value of those habitats because it's very attractive.
How far do you have to go back to establish belonging?
Well, exactly. Well, you tell me. I mean, I don't know. It depends what you're talking about, depends where you are in the world. I mean, you know, Australians are still having this argument among themselves about dingoes, you know. Are dingoes a native Australian animal or not, you know, because people took them to Australia, but that was about 5,000 years ago. So is that long enough? It depends very strongly on whether you like the plant or you like the animal.
Uh-huh, that's it. You point to in the book a beauty bias. Now, what do you mean by that? And how does that influence how we regard and how we talk about invasive species?
Well, we just adjust our definitions of what's native and alien, at least we do in this country, depending on what we like. So, I mean, almost all our arable weeds, our weeds of cereal crops in this country are aliens because they were brought here by early farmers. So they were brought here by people. But because many of them are very attractive, things like poppies and so on, we tend to go around treating them as native. And there's nothing we like more as conservationists than as things that are pretty and rare. So we spend a lot of time conserving them. But they're not native.
So is our reaction to invasive species reactionary or is something even more sinister? Is there a kind of xenophobia that goes with, you know, something came from the outside and it was probably carried by other people?
Yeah, I think maybe humans are basically xenophobic. Maybe our history means that we like people who are members of our family or of our immediate tribe. And we're just programmed to distrust or fear anyone or anything that isn't familiar, you know, and turns up unexpectedly.
We're talking with Dr. Ken Thompson. He's a longtime lecturer at the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield in England, now writes on gardening for the Daily Telegraph. And we're talking about his book, Where Do Camels Belong? It's a book questioning our beliefs and assumptions about invasive species. Are they all bad? Well, Dr. Thompson, let's clarify that you are not advocating to welcome or accept all invasive species, or are you?
Oh, good Lord, no. Some people have criticized me for as though that's what I am saying, but I'm definitely not. I just think we should be a little more objective about this because, you know, a few alien species, you know, can be shown to cause real problems, real economic harm or real ecological harm. And those are the ones we should focus on. You know, we've only got enough, so much time and money to spend on this. Let's be honest, you know, we have more important things to worry about. And if we go around treating all alien species as though they need eradicating or controlling, then we're not going to do a very good job. We need to focus on the ones that really do cause a problem.
Well, how do we make that decision? Should we be more concerned about the recent invaders? I'm thinking of the zebra mussels or Asian carp or the long-horned Asian beetle here in New England than say, wild rabbits, which are a nuisance in England.
I don't think the time a species has been around has anything to do with it. I think we should just have some objective criteria where we add up the benefits and the problems that are caused by an alien species. You know, I mean, you mentioned zebra mussel now. Zebra mussels do a lot of good, quite honestly. We could go into details of exactly what they do.
Aren't they things that clog up pipes and can damage plumbing or stop it altogether?
Yeah, they can grow inside water pipes and things and cause a problem. But frankly, you know, there are fairly simple technical solutions for that. And in fact, they're great at filtering grot, you know, crud out of water, so they purify water. They're a great food source for water birds. They have a lot going for them, really.
But they killed off clams in many areas, haven't they?
Well, that's what people who don't like them claim. But you know, the evidence for that is really quite poor, actually. And there's strong evidence that the clams that are declining were declining before the zebra mussel turned up, and mainly it's habitat change and it's pollution that's doing for the clams, not the zebra mussels.
We often focus on the ecological problems that invasive species cause. But in truth, are they man-made? Because that's often how they travel. You know, I guess I'm asking, have invasive species been scapegoated?
Oh, all the time. Many, many examples of where species are simply filling an ecological vacuum that's been caused by human activity. I mean, let's face it, mankind has completely transformed this planet. And to expect, quite honestly, that the species which lived in a particular place are going to be the ones best adapted to that spot now that mankind has changed it beyond recognition is frankly a little bit unreasonable, don't you think?
Any particular species come to mind that has been the most vilified?
Oh, the most vilified? Oh, heaven. Well, that depends entirely where you are.
Okay, there in the UK, let's say.
In the UK, you mentioned invasive species. People, if they're thinking of plants, they say Japanese knotweed. If you mention animals, most people would mention it. It's one of yours, I'm afraid. It's the American gray squirrel. Mm. That's the one people most hate.
All right. So we'll try and get over the anti-American bias of looking at the gray squirrel in that way. Well, in the book, you write about five myths about invasive species in which you refer to all of the species as aliens. Is there one in particular that really stands out for you as a myth that's led us down the wrong path?
The most important one, I suppose, was the idea that aliens are always amazingly expensive. Hmm. You know, that they cost a lot of money. When I was researching this book, I found time and time again the costs that were attributed to an alien species were wildly exaggerated. They often never took account at all of any benefits of alien species, and the costs were often completely imaginary. The greater part of them was often costs spent on trying to control a species. Hmm. And although this should be obvious, but think about it for a moment. The costs of trying to control something cannot be a reason for trying to do that control in the first place.
What would be an example of that calculation?
Well, the example that I quote in the book is purple loosestrife.
This is a weed that's all over here in
this
in
is
the
a
US.
Weed that's all over North America, and it's one of ours. It's very well behaved here, if you look that up, you can find various estimates. The usual estimate is, which is quite old now, so probably it's a bigger figure, but $45 million a year is apparently what it costs, what people spend every year on actually trying to control purple loosestrife. But there's no real evidence that a single cent of that is money well spent. In other words, I don't think anyone's ever shown that there would be less purple loosestrife if those $45 million were not spent. So whether that's a real cost or not can definitely be argued, I think.
Well, all right, you can keep your well-behaved purple loosestrife, and we'll try and contain our gray squirrels here in the U.S. I want to thank you for opening up a really interesting topic for us, Dr. Thompson.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Ken Thompson. He was for 20 years a lecturer in the Department of Animal and Plant Sciences at the University of Sheffield. His previous book was called Do We Need Pandas? The Uncomfortable Truth About Diversity. Equally provocative, his newest book, Where Do Camels Belong? Why Invasive Species Are Not All Bad. You can find more on both at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, although the Boise River in Idaho suffers from a few invasive species, Asian carp and the false indigo bush, to name a few, that is not stopping fly fishermen from getting out on the water. Up next, we're going to learn about some vets that use fishing as a form of therapy for PTSD. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's estimated that up to 20% of veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan are suffering or will suffer from PTSD. Treatment for the disorder ranges from intensive therapy to meditative hobbies like model building or yoga, knitting, even fly fishing. In fact, a recent study found significant improvements in perceptual stress, anxiety, and sleep quality for vets who took part in a 2-day, 3-night fly fishing retreat. Producer Jessica Murray weighed it out with a group of veterans in Idaho for their first fishing trip and brings us the story.
Early morning is when the fish bite. It's 5 a.m., totally dark, and 6 military vets are standing around a couple of pickups smoking cigarettes. One has a Purple Heart license plate and a wheelchair in the bed. The others are inked, and when they joke at each other, nothing is off limits. Slams on Yo Mama zing back and forth. They're heading to the South Fork of the Boise River on this Sunday morning in southwest Idaho. They're going fly fishing. The trucks cross the Anderson Ranch Dam and drop into a gorge of dirt road, wheelchair bouncing at every pothole. This is not a guided trip with some nonprofit devoted to fly fishing. These are just the friends of Jake Thacker.
My name's Jake Thacker. I was born in Boise, Idaho.
How long have you been fly fishing?
Since I was 8.
Thacker met these guys through the Idaho Veterans Network, and today, he's making them trade their structured Thursday night support group for a day on the river. Most of them have never even held a fly rod.
Pull it out till you get your fly line out. Look at that.
Eric Karen has a little experience fly fishing and tries to teach one of the other guys how to cast.
Don't fight me.
I'm trying not to.
So, back, pause. That one. Did you feel the difference?
No. First timer.
They're standing before an iconic Idaho landscape. Golden hills, morning sun glinting off the river, birds and birch trees, the smell of bug spray. They test the height of their waders in the water, and their casts look nothing like the magazine cover fly fishermen.
I'd forgotten how much it was therapeutic, really. Just being, you know, out on a river, catching fish.
Fly fishing helped Thacker return his life to normal after getting back from the invasion of Iraq. He says war is the hardest thing he's ever done. He called it life-changing, and not in a good way.
I mean, I was depressed. I had substance abuse problems. I isolated, but getting out, it took my mind off all that, I felt good, you know, because I actually went outside and did something.
His friends have seen the change in him since he started fly fishing again. George Nickel is the vice president of the Idaho Veterans Network, and he remembers when he
first met Jake. Yep.
What was he like?
He was a basket case. Well, he was going, handling a lot of his problems on his own and just internalizing a lot of stuff and coping with problems in self-destructive manners. And I think when I first met Jake, I didn't even know he had a sense of humor. There was no humor involved in it. It was all business, all seriousness. And now there's actually good times.
Nickel's fingers are thick with silver rings. He wades out into the river alone and casts his fly rod calmly, repetitively. It's a stark difference from his rock bottom in 2009, when Nickel put on his combat vest, grabbed his rifle and his handgun, and started shooting down the hall of his apartment complex. He ended up in an armed standoff with the Boise Police Department.
It's two different universes. I mean, where I was at then to where I'm at now, because usually on Sunday this time of day, I'd be, you know, knee-deep in a 24-pack, and I couldn't imagine standing out here learning how to fly fish because I really didn't envision any type of future at all.
Nickel owns a fly rod now. And for Thacker, he goes fly fishing 3 times a week. It's his goal to get other vets outside, like James Donaldson.
I'm going to turn you around.
Yeah.
With some help from his friends, Donaldson gets his wheelchair to the bank of the river, and Thacker hands him a pole.
Last time I fished, I was still in high school, and it's like after I turned 18.
Donaldson's legs end at his knees. He lost them on his tour in Iraq.
It was the morning of July 14th.
And they had just finished a patrol with the police.
We just got done doing a patrol with the police.
Donaldson was driving between two other Humvees when he got hit by an IED.
P-shaped charge IED. Didn't feel anything. I tried to stop the Humvee but couldn't hit the brakes. I guess my left leg was like gone, like nothing left of it.
His right leg was still there, but
it was still on the gas pedal.
So the vehicle didn't stop until it ran into something. Donaldson doesn't remember what that something was.
Had a hard time adapting. I didn't leave my apartment. I didn't do anything. Really leave my apartment at all or do anything. Like, pretty much from 07 till the beginning of 09.
Since then, Donaldson has learned to play basketball from his chair. He's gone bowling and shooting, ridden four-wheelers, played ping pong, and now fly fishing.
It's still an everyday thing for me. It's still hard to accept the fact that I don't have my legs, but I never would have met these guys, honestly. I don't think I ever would have.
I just hope he has a good time and enjoys himself. Hopefully he catches a fish. I'd really like to get him hooked. It's good for him. He says he needs to get out. I agree. I try to get more people out.
Decker is going to school now to get his degree in business. With that, he plans to open his own guide service. This isn't just a hobby, but something he wants to do with his life. And he started reaching out to businesses, trying to get fly fishing gear and trips donated to the Idaho Veterans Network. He's always looking to take more vets out on the water and get them hooked, too.
Have you guys caught anything yet?
No.
Nothing?
No thing.
These guys didn't catch a single fish the whole day, but that didn't matter to them. That's not what this was about. This was about relaxation. It was about fresh air and Idaho wilderness. It's about recovery. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Jessica Murray.
The Cold War may be over, but the cold storage boom is in full swing in China. Up next, we're going to hear about the dramatic growth in refrigerator ownership and what it means for China's economy and global climate change. That's after the news when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's such an everyday act, opening up the fridge to grab a snack or a carton of milk. But let's take that carton and follow it back from the shelf through all the steps it took to get to the store where you bought it and the packaging it's in and how it got from farm to plant, maintaining the proper chill at every step. Artificial cooling accounts for a whopping 15% of the world's energy consumption and directly contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. is by far the world leader in household refrigerators, but China is on pace to overtake American cold storage consumption in the next decade. Nicola Twilley is currently working on a book about refrigeration. Her recent article for the New York Times Magazine asks, "What do Chinese dumplings have to do with global warming?" And she's here to help us understand both the question and the answer. Nicola, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
The luxury of owning a refrigerator and a freezer in the home is a relatively new one in China. Now, when did this cold storage boom, as you call it, first begin?
Well, at the start of the 90s, fewer than 1 in 10 Chinese people had a refrigerator in their home. Today, it's 95% of urban families. So that got started in the 90s and is really complete now. The other part of the refrigeration boom is the part you don't tend to see in your day-to-day life, which is refrigerated warehouses and refrigerated trucks and all of the sort of behind the scenes, what the industry experts call the cold chain, which is a seamless network of refrigeration from farm to your refrigerator.
And that is part of what your article details. But first, you write that now 95% of urban households in China do own a refrigerator. With such a small percentage of the population left, which I still know is significant in China, how much further does the cold storage boom have to go before it tops out?
Oh, it has a long way to go. First of all, those numbers are for urban Chinese. The situation in the countryside is very different. There is still fewer, it's a minority of people that have a refrigerator. So there's still a lot of growth, even just in the domestic refrigerator market. In terms of actual cold storage at the national level, if you think every single American has 13 cubic foot of refrigerated space per capita, that it's somewhere out there with your name on it. And a Chinese person, even after a decade's worth of this cold storage boom, has just under 4 cubic feet. So less than a third of what we have in the U.S., really. So there's a long way to grow.
Well, let's get back to this idea that introducing frozen food does not just, you know, happen at the point of getting from a store to a home refrigerator. It is an elaborate infrastructure getting a meal from a manufacturer to the dinner plate. This is what you referred to earlier as the cold chain. Can you just describe some of the stages in that chain?
Well, take a frozen dumpling, for example, which is the most popular frozen food in China. In the U.S., frozen pizza is by far and away the most popular frozen food. But Chinese people don't like cheese as a general rule. So it's the dumpling that has sort of been the gateway frozen food there. And that has to be made in the cold. It has to be flash frozen in a factory, has to be stored in that factory, kept freezing. When it's ready to go out, you need trucks that can keep it at freezing. they're going to distribute it to a warehouse probably on the edge of a city somewhere, perhaps belonging to a Walmart, perhaps belonging to a different distributor or a wholesaler. And then from there, smaller trucks tend to take it into the city, either to a grocery store or, as is increasingly happening in China, direct to the consumers as people get, they're sort of leapfrogging the supermarket stage and going straight into e-grocery shopping.
So a lot to be done, a lot of money to be made, and this has become a very important government-aided initiative. So what are some of the social benefits or health benefits to refrigeration?
Well, I think the main things are food safety. I mean, obviously, as we see in the headlines every day, food safety is a pressing issue in China. And refrigeration is and a seamless cold chain is one way to really cut down on that. There was a study done by a consulting firm that showed that Chinese consumers expect to have an upset stomach from bad food twice a week. That's totally normal for them. That's the average.
Wow.
And a lot of that is just from the fact that, I mean, currently in China, less than a quarter of meat is transported under refrigeration. The number for vegetables is 5%. So you can imagine that a lot of bad things are happening as that food travels from where it's grown to where it's going to be eaten. And refrigeration could help prevent a lot of that.
And also prevent waste.
That's the other big thing. At the moment, China throws away 40%, I mean nearly half actually, of what it grows. And it throws it away in that journey between the producer and then the retailer. So before a consumer ever gets to even see this, half of what China grows has been thrown away. And it's simply because it rots en route. You can't keep it fresh, especially in the summer. I went to the wholesale market that supplies 80% of Beijing's vegetables, and the farmers had packed individual heads of broccoli in ice and hay to try and keep it cold and insulated.
Uh-huh.
And they just dig out one head at a time and sell it to people. But you can't, the farmer told me he expects to lose a quarter of the truck in summer.
To create a flawless cold chain would take significant energy. Where is China sourcing most of its energy from now? Is it still coal?
Yes, it is still coal, unfortunately. So it's the dirtiest kind of energy. And it's not just electricity that is the problem, actually, with refrigeration. There's this the issue of what chemicals you use inside your refrigeration system. They're called refrigerants. And I think a lot of us thought we dealt with the refrigerant problem when we got rid of CFCs and we stopped, you know, forming the hole in the ozone layer in the 80s. But unfortunately, their replacements, HFCs, turn out to be sort of 1,000 times, if not more, some of them are even more warming than that, but 1,000 times more warming than carbon dioxide as greenhouse gases.
And these HFCs are discharged or formed because of refrigeration.
Yeah, we make these chemicals because they are the chemicals that sort of run around inside the refrigeration system, you know, in those coils. They're the ones performing the heat exchange. They leak different amounts from different systems. Supermarkets can leak as much as, you know, 15-20% a year. And because they're chosen for use as refrigerants because they're so stable, but because they're so stable, they sit in the atmosphere forever. And they're, like I say, they have 1,000 times more, they call it global warming potential. So for every ton of those, it's 1,000 times more warming than a ton of CO2.
Nicola Twilley is with us. She's writing a book on refrigeration and recently wrote about China's cold storage boom for the New York Times Magazine. As this cold chain expands, China is also experiencing huge leaps forward, if I can use those terms, huge leaps forward in energy efficiency and the growth of renewable resources. Now, might some of those efforts help mitigate some of the energy needs that cold storage requires?
Oh, absolutely. You can both make a refrigeration system more efficient and you can power it with clean energy. Definitely. And those don't affect the refrigerant problem, but they do affect the electricity problem, which is 80% of the environmental impact of a cold storage warehouse comes from the electricity use. So you can absolutely do that. The question is, can you do it at the scale? I mean, the thing that is easy to sometimes forget about China is that there are 1.4 billion people there. And if they all have even half as much refrigeration as we do in the U.S., that's an awful lot of clean energy to find and doesn't exist right now.
It's so interesting because I remember, you know, 10 years ago, I guess, conversations about global warming or energy conservation all somehow got to, well, everybody in India and China is now going to want cars. And now the conversation is about refrigeration, something far less obvious.
It's sort of, I mean, and that's why I'm so obsessed with refrigeration. I feel as though we completely overlook it. It's sort of this invisible network that we completely rely on. It's the only thing that keeps our food system in the U.S. running. It's the only way you feed our cities is through refrigeration. And yet most people couldn't take you to the nearest refrigerated warehouse or even point out a refrigerated truck on the highway.
Mm. Well, it's certainly changed the way Americans eat. How has refrigeration changed the way people in China eat?
Well, it's very interesting at the moment because, and this is one of the reasons I was so excited to travel to China for the Times, because they're refrigerating in fast forward. They're cooling down the entire food system, but it's so quickly that you see generational shifts in action. So the old folk, I had an old lady teach me how to make dumplings from scratch, and I asked her whether she would rather have a bike or a refrigerator if she could only have one. And she just looked at me like I was stupid. Like, obviously she would keep the bike. I mean, how else would she get around? You don't need a refrigerator. Whereas my 26-year-old interpreter that I traveled around with had no bike, depended on his refrigerator, and lived on frozen dumplings. It's really, you know, the older generation are still shopping in wet markets. They're still shopping every day and cooking it fresh that evening. They're still making these things by hand, preserving things traditionally. If you walk around Beijing, people will be air-drying sausages outside their window, for example, things like that. And the younger generation, absolutely not. Don't know how to cook, don't want to know. Very much convenience-focused, as we are in the U.S.
Nicola Twilley is a writer currently working on a book about refrigeration. You can find a link to her recent article for the New York Times Magazine, which is called "What Do Chinese Dumplings Have to Do with Global Warming?" That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to continue to peer into the refrigerator, this time the mini variety. Up next, the author of a cookbook designed for college students' ultimate dining hall hacks. That's after the break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In just a few short weeks, kids will be returning to school, and that includes more than 20 million college students moving into dorm rooms all across the country, buying books, and for many, readjusting or introducing themselves to dining hall food options. If dining hall tedium affects you or someone you love, here's some help. Dartmouth graduate Priya Krishna has written a cookbook called Ultimate Dining Hacks, which presents inventive ways to create your own quasi-gourmet meals out of the culinary building blocks found in most college dining halls. Word of Mouth's intern and returning college senior, Molly Donahue, spoke with Priya about the cookbook.
So you have this very helpful Q&A section in the beginning of the book spelling out your qualifications and how to use the cookbook. What exactly are your qualifications?
Aside from being an avid consumer of food, I started this column my freshman year of college where I created meals out of the ingredients found in dining halls and wrote about it each week. And from that, I got hired by my school's dining services to be basically their consultant. And then eventually, they were going to these dining hall conferences across the country, and I was the only person that was driver certified at our college. So I started driving like busfuls of these like old dining administrators to these conferences. And from those conferences, I ended up going and like learning all about what is found in the average dining hall and interviewing dining hall providers and basically building up the content that eventually led to the book.
The book features these really cute graphics and flowcharts. Do you think the visuals will really speak to college students?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of like there's flowcharts are almost like create your own adventure. You want pasta. Okay, do you want pasta with sauce? Do you want it without sauce? Do you want it like this kind of sauce or the other kind of sauce? I feel like it very much speaks to college students in an easy and accessible way. I think that the problem with a lot of cookbooks targeted towards college students is that it assumes that college students have two things that they don't, and those are time and resources. And so I think the way it's laid out is very much a like, take these recipes and adapt them to what you have on hand and what you have available, and most importantly, what you like to eat. And that's why there are no real photographs. It's more graphic-driven, because I don't want people to think that it has to look a very certain way, but rather that they can adapt it to what they like.
I definitely picked up some tips for when I return to a very tight apartment kitchen. So do you think your cookbook would appeal to someone who's long since graduated and moved on from dorm life?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is sad. Maybe it's not, but I use the recipes and tips in my cookbook pretty much the exact same amount, having graduated and living in a small apartment, as I did when I was actually in college, eating at the dining halls every day. So I think that anyone that, even in the summer, you know, it's really annoying to have to turn on an oven or a stove. You don't have to do that. You want to make a full meal in a very short amount of time. You can use these recipes. They're all just kind of like tips and tricks at the end of the day.
Have you always been interested in cooking, or like so many other things, did you discover it in college?
I'd always been interested in food and eating. My mom, her and my dad immigrated here from India in the 80s, and she didn't know how to cook. And so she learned how to cook watching those, like the really old school PBS cooking shows. And so when I was growing up, my mom said she would like put my crib in front of the PBS cooking shows, and I would just watch the cooking shows with her. And that's how she learned to cook. And that's kind of how I learned about food. And I would sit and do my homework. This is from like middle school through high school, and sit on the kitchen counter and just watch her cook. I don't know. I kind of concluded that I'm a fine cook, but I'm much better. Like I'd rather, like I really enjoy the challenge of being given really limited resources and creating something extraordinary.
These recipes are really inventive, and there are some classes like a creative chicken pot pie and some new dishes like a loaded sweet potato press or an apple cinnamon grilled cheese, which is on the cover. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with them all?
I kind of draw inspiration from a lot of different sources, but one thing I try to do is take things that are familiar to me and that I really like and invent them in new ways. So an example of that is there's a recipe for a peanut butter and jelly ice cream sundae, and I realized that my favorite combination in the world is peanut butter and strawberry jam. So I might as well try and apply that to like everything I possibly can and see where it works best.
The word mash comes up a lot in the cookbook, which I am a big fan of.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that when you're writing a cookbook of this kind, you just have to sort of keep in mind that college students don't really have sophisticated cooking equipment. They have forks, knives, and spoons, and then like a panini press. And so when I was writing out the recipes, I had to be really aware of that.
Did you ever try a food combination that didn't work out?
Yes. There's one famously bad recipe. I tried to like do a variation on like a, I guess a corn pudding is the best, or like creamed corn. And it was so bad. Just thinking about it kind of makes me a little bit nauseous. But rest assured, I won't be making creamed corn anytime soon.
So if you had to choose, what's your favorite recipe or which one would you recommend newcomers to try?
Dessert recipes are my favorite. An easy one for newcomers, probably my chocolate chip cookie dough. It's this recipe for chocolate chip cookie dough that has no raw egg in it, so no salmonella, but it tastes exactly like cookie dough.
So finally, do you have any advice to people trying to eat well in college?
Yeah. One of the biggest tips I have is, aside from, you know, I said before about finding flavors you like and apply it in new ways, like don't be limited by the confines of the station. Say you find pesto in the sandwich section, you should put that on your salad and use it as dressing. And at the end of the day, 90% of the time, if you don't like what you are eating, you can melt cheese on it and it will probably taste good.
Priya Krishna there, Dartmouth graduate and author of Ultimate Dining Hall Hacks. If you'd like to find more on the book, including some recipes, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Planning a movie date this weekend? You could just do it at home. In our monthly segment, On Demand, producer Taylor Quimby offers up unusual suggestions for online movie watching. This month, Taylor is looking at a largely hidden genre, the secret remake.
Remakes, like sequels, have something of an unsavory reputation. While a select few exceed the quality of their predecessors, many others leave audiences wondering why they didn't just rent the original. On the other hand, we can't help but want to compare remakes to the classics they seek to displace. That's why the internet was all abuzz last week over the release of the new trailer for Mad Max, Fury Road, our first look at Tom Hardy as the new and improved post-apocalyptic road warrior himself.
My name is Max. My world is fire and blood.
Okay, so Mad Max Fury Road isn't technically a remake. It's more like a post-Mel Gibson facelift. That being said, there are lots of high-quality remakes that manage to avoid being labeled at all. Case in point, Terry Gilliam's 1995 science fiction film 12 Monkeys, starring Brad Pitt as an unhinged animal activist and Bruce Willis as a perpetually confused time traveler.
They paint this. They stencil this on the sides of buildings everywhere. Have you seen this?
Mr. Cole.
Have you seen this?
Why don't you just take your time and try to explain this whole thing from the beginning?
Right, right. It's 1990. Okay.
Well, if you go back to the real beginning, you'll discover 12 Monkeys is actually based off Chris Marker's 1962 short film, La Jetée. And bear with me, because we're going to be doing a lot of time traveling in the next couple minutes.
I'm not saying you're not mentally ill. For all I know, you're crazy as a loon.
Many under-the-radar remakes are adapted from foreign language films, like 2001's Vanilla Sky and the 1992 drama Scent of a Woman, which earned Al Pacino his only Academy Award.
Yes, Mr. Sims. There's only two syllables in this whole wide world worth hearing.
And no, those two syllables are not remake. But that didn't stop Pacino from starring in another one 10 years earlier, as drug kingpin Tony Montana in Scarface.
Every dog has his day.
Or two, if you're keeping count. Scarface first hit theaters in 1932.
Hey, look at the monkeys there! They think they're going to get Tony Camani, eh?
Another organized crime flick you might not have realized was a remake? Martin Scorsese's 2006 film, The Departed. While Jack Nicholson's sinister performance as Boston mob boss Frank Costello drew comparisons to real-life gangster Whitey Bulger, The Departed was hardly novel. The plot was borrowed from the 2002 Hong Kong-based thriller Infernal Affairs. Here's a clip from that same famous rooftop climax that appeared in Scorsese's version. I smell a rat. Lest you think all remakes are derived from mob movies and sci-fi films, consider the 1996 comedy The Birdcage, based off the 1978 French release La Cage aux Folles. Or the Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan rom-com You've Got Mail, which is actually based off a movie that debuted long before the advent of AOL.
Tell me, who is the girl?
Oh, you know that girl I was corresponding with?
Oh, yes, about the cultural subjects.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. Well, after a while, we got on the subject of love.
Recognize that voice? That, of course, was Jimmy Stewart, the Tom Hanks of yesteryear, in the 1940 movie The Shop Around the Corner. When it comes right down to it, most movies can be boiled down to just a handful of prototypical plot lines. The hero's quest, the rags-to-riches tale, the fall from grace story. So before you roll your eyes at the next big-budget remake, remember, it's all been done. The question is whether it's done right. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Head on over to wordofmouthradio.org for Taylor's complete list of movies and TV shows being made available this month on Netflix, Redbox, and Amazon Prime. And we'd love to know which hidden gems you found streaming on Netflix. Was there a documentary that knocked your socks off? an obscure TV show that blew your mind. You can add your suggestions on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the best guilty pleasures travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us again for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.